Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. I'm your host, Tom Mazure, and we are on a special mission today. Actually, I didn't expect to be where I am today, and you don't know where I'm at. We're in Ross Common. We're in northern Michigan. There has been a number of fires. We're in the height of fire season, but it's early. It's a fire season, and so I have Kevin Jacobs of the Department of Natural Resources Air Patrol. Welcome to our program, Kevin.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
Kevin, what are we going to be looking at today? Who are we going to interview, and what are their roles and functions?
Well, today, not only are we going to talk about the aviation assets that the Department of Natural Resources uses for fire detection, but we're going to talk with Randy Hartman. He's one of our experienced fire officers based in Roscommon.
The boots on the ground.
He is, boots on the ground, and we have many like Randy. And then we're going to swing by the Forest Fire Experiment Station, which I think as that conversation develops, you'll see it's quite a unique facility for the state, but it's a place that we engineer and build, design fire equipment that we use in the woods.
And where we're sitting right now, we're sitting in an airplane hangar up in northern Michigan. We're actually sitting underneath the wing. You'll have to see that on the picture when we post it. With that in mind, let's have a word of prayer and get started with our interview. Our Father in Heaven, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to look into how these people at the Department of Natural Resources are looking after our interests. Lord, be with our listeners as they listen to this program, that your name will be glorified. In Jesus' name, amen. Listeners, literally, this is real time. We did recordings on fire prevention with the U.S. Forest Service. You'll be hearing some of those programs before and after this particular broadcast. But last week, this is being recorded on June the 8th. Literally, there has been forest fires already going on. We happen to be at the Strong Tower Radio Variety Hour down in Berrien Springs after we saw Pastor Kelly leave the platform at the as we were doing the closing of the program, and he came back after we were off the recording, and he shared with us there was a fire up in Grayling, and we should have a word of prayer for the firefighters and for the place that is near and dear to many of our listeners who vacation up in the north in the Grayling area, and specifically Camp Asabo. But he came on and said the fire, if the wind changes just a little bit, it's in close proximity to the camp. And that really made forest fires to be real to me. And Kevin, you know, earlier this week when we were recording it, we had smoke drifting in from Western Canada. A forest fires is not always a localized experience. It affects large areas and sometimes the fallout from the smoke. You are an air patrol. Tell us what your role is in this. You're the eyes in the sky.
Well, that's true. And I would take back just a little bit to some of the history to where we got to this point. And before aviation was used extensively, we had fire towers.
And I mean, that was iconic. You out west, they have these large expanses of forested area, and on top of every so far, every, I don't know, distance 20 mil, wherever you could see with binoculars and such, you had somebody up in a fire tower.
You did. And we had as many as 150 fire
towers. Just in Michigan.
Just in Michigan. So if you could imagine the influx of staffing needs seasonally, that would be a challenge today. Now, I will say that the fire towers were fairly effective at triangulating fires. Now, one tower.
What is a triangulate?
So, yeah, one tower would see a smoke, so they could give you a bearing from that tower, but that could be anywhere from 1 mile away to, you know, maybe 30 miles away. So you have another fire tower that would spot that same smoke, and then they could give you a bearing from that tower. So in doing so, from two or three towers, you triangulate the position of that fire, where that smoke is. Now, you have to remember that smoke is drifting. So are they really seeing the base of the fire, or are they seeing the smoke that's drifting off that fire? But generally speaking, they were pretty good at honing in on that area. Approximately the 19, we can actually go back archival and find that the state of Michigan used aircraft as early as the mid-1930s.
Wow.
And we have a photo
so
that
we're
shows,
coming up on 90 plus years.
Yes, it's been a while. And I don't know to the extent that they used it, but we have an archival photo of a 1935 Porterfield, which is a tail dragger, small aircraft, parked next to a van of that era that says forest fire radios on the side. So again, what level of communication they had, we're not sure. But the program really got going with aviation up into the 1950s. And by the time the 1960s rolled around, they pretty much retired the fire towers and replaced it with aircraft. If you go back to that same scenario where there is a smoke and a person from an aircraft can locate that, we use what we ask for a legal system. So it's a section, township, and a range.
Right.
So we can narrow it down right to a square mile. We have GPS coordinates that we can use. So not only do we give them an accurate location, but we can do something that the fire tower people couldn't do, and that is to tell them what size the fire is, we can tell them what the fire behavior is, and what types of fuels that fire is burning.
And what is a fuel?
We have multiple different kinds of fuels. Grass would be one, hardwoods, and then we have pine. We can divide that up a little bit further in the pine area. We have developed an eye from the air to tell you if it's jack pine or red pine, or if it's some sort of a spruce like a lowland conifer. That's important information for our fire officers because that can dictate to some degree
how fast,
what type of a fire they're gonna, yeah.
How intense, or?
It can be with intensity and so on.
So what is the current system of the fire control? There are different units we've learned. This year has been fabulous. We've been working with the U.S. Forest Department. We've been with the DNR. We've got to learn biologists and such, and each one has their area. The Department of Natural Resources is a very big operation here in the state of Michigan. It has many, some is on wildlife and some is on forestry and lakes and camping and recreation.
Well, I think that's right. And typically from the public eye, we view conservation officers, they have a large presence. They're the law enforcement division of our department.
For the hunting side.
Yep, so they would enforce game laws, but they're actually, they have the same authority as a Michigan State police officer. So they are state peace officers. And then you also see the parks side. That's something that we all enjoy. So those two entities probably comes to mind when we talk about Department of Natural Resources. But you're correct. There's many other divisions. If I were to rattle them all off on top of my head, I would miss some, I'm sure. But wildlife, I'm in the Forest Resources Division, and that's where our firefighting group is housed. But as as we talk to other people later today, you will find that, you know, we pull in individuals from other divisions because we only have so many people in our division. Sometimes these fires can get big. They become a very large project. So we're thankful that other divisions are willing to get fire line qualified and then come in to assist us.
It's kind of an ad hoc. I mean, you're having a Department of Natural Resources, but you're having also you're cooperating often with local firefighting units of townships, cities, villages.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Just the beginning.
That's exactly right.
All hands on deck.
And we have a very good relationship with the U.S. Forest Service as, you know, a national agency. So we're very fortunate to have, you know, partnerships across the state.
Well, tell us the experience of being in the air. And you're going to go off. What is prime time? What is a normal day during fire season for you?
Typically in the earlier AM part of the day, you have higher humidities. You don't have the heating of the day. So
heat is a big factor.
It is. So,
Moisture on the plants and on the ground and in the air.
Exactly. So you can imagine that most of our fires are going to occur once you get past the noon hour. You get, again, that drying period all morning. The relative humidities become lower. It's not uncommon for the wind to pick up a little bit more in the afternoon, and that can be variable. So our typical detection will take place at 1 o'clock. That's our departure time. And we'll fly for two and a half to 3 hours, land for fuel, and then fly for another 2.5 to 3 hours.
Until you don't quite go to sunset on a normal day?
Not on a normal day, because again, once you get towards the end of the day,
it starts cooling.
It cools off, your RAs start coming back up again. And so you're out of that most critical phase of fires.
So you hear a radio in the background. This is real. We're literally in a hangar. How many fires is a typical year, and how many have we had so far this year?
Well, that's a good question. I have some data here that is available right off the DNR website. But total fires to date, we've had 207 wildfires.
Wow.
That includes the Upper Peninsula and the Lower Peninsula. And that equates to over 3,200 acres that has been burnt due to wildfires. Now, we know that just recently we had the Wilderness Trail fire. That's the one that threatened Camp Asabo and some of the other areas up there. When you factor all of that in there, that means we've burned on average about 15 acres per fire. But if you pull that one big fire out, we've been able to maintain an average of about 4 acres per fire. And that's really the goal, is we want to get to fires quickly. And that's, today we have cell phones, so you get reporting very quickly that way. But then again, from the aircraft, if it's a more remote area, if it's a lightning strike or a power line down, something that maybe someone didn't know about, that's something that we can detect, get that information in quickly, and try to keep the fire small.
Let's talk about the aerial suppression, and it was quite dramatic with the Wilderness Trail fire over the Grayling Camp Asabo. There was a picture of double prop helicopter hovering over the lake, sucking up water.
Yes, that was a fire that occurred in a pretty volatile area. So that was heavily jack pine. There were also some red pine, which also is a pretty volatile fuel. And then there was ultimately some hardwoods up towards what we call the head of the fire. So it got a start, and again, it was at that about 1 o'clock in the afternoon when it really got going.
Who saw it first, or was it?
That was called in.
Called in from the ground.
First.
From a civilian.
And interestingly, you mentioned the drift smoke that we're experiencing from Canada. That particular day, our detection aircraft could only see about 5 miles away. So our visibility is much limited compared to a normal day.
What is normal?
You could see 30 miles on a clear day, 30, 40 miles. Okay. And that type of fire would have stood out very well on a clear day. But I literally was within 5 miles
and
of it
before. You didn't see it?
I didn't see it initially. Within 5 miles after it was reported, I saw it, and we tried to document through photos early on. So when I first arrived, it was a half of an acre, and watched it develop to 2,400 acres.
Wow, and then over what period of time?
So from 1 o'clock, and then I flew that fire until about 9:30 that evening.
Tell us about, was there anything of interest that made that fire unique?
I would say that not unique. We see that type of fire behavior.
It's more typical.
It's pretty typical in that fire, in that fuel type. I will say in that instance, we talk about the parts of a fire. And there's some military lingo to that. If somebody had the military background, they would understand when we say we're working a right flank or a left flank. And then up towards the head of the fire is where the fire is raging. And we had an instance on that fire where the left flank, there was a slight wind change that what I would say blew up. So when we say a flank blew up, that means it went to a crown, so it sustained crown in the tops of the trees.
And we're going to talk about that later
with Randy. And that put a lot of fire over our established fire line. So you can imagine
it's burst out.
Yeah, the risk there. We already have equipment on that line. The fire spilled out, as you might imagine, over that line. So then we had to direct folks on the ground to make sure that they were in a safe place.
And air was an important part of that direction.
And what we do, you mentioned suppression, and the aircraft we fly are quite simple. These are single-engine Cessnas. They're very efficient, and they're easy to maintain. So they work very well for what we use here. But some states may have mountainous terrain or higher elevations that they have to maneuver. So they might have either twin engine aircraft or turboprop, jet engines hooked to props to work in that environment. But our aircraft are for detection. But like you mentioned, there was a Chinook helicopter. We had Michigan State Police helicopter. That's a Huey, like a Vietnam era, a Huey helicopter. There were 4 fire bosses, which are basically agricultural crop dusting type airplanes, but they're they're mounted on amphibious floats, so they can actually land in that particular day in Lake Marguerite and Grayling, and they could land, and it scoops up water into
even
their hopper.
Even if they're moving along.
Exactly. They have to be moving along to scoop that water. They can load about 800 gallons in their hopper and do a very quick turn. They can drop that water on the fire, get back to the lake and re-scoop. And then later in the day, we had the Bombardier CL-415s, which are similar. They're also scooper aircraft, but they can haul more like 1,500 gallons. So a pretty big unit. So between fixed wing assets and rotor wing, we had all of that supporting from the air. And while we make very good use of the aerial suppression, they don't really put the fire out from the air. When we talk to Randy a little later today, you'll find that that equipment on the ground is what puts the fire out. But these aerial resources allow our ground equipment to fight more aggressively to stay on the line. They can help cool that line down, and they can steer the fire to some extent. If we have a structure that's being threatened, and if we really hit that hard from the air with that water, they can dictate that fire around those structures to some extent. In Western fires, and I've fought out of state as a ground crew person on some of these other fires, and you have mountainous terrain, so you can put a lookout in a vantage point to see what's going on the ground. We don't have that here. So we become the lookout for our ground forces. Now, we don't manage the fire from the air. We're simply trying to paint the picture. In fact, Tom, you'd probably be a very good fire detection pilot.
Wow.
Because that's what you do. You paint the picture for your radio audience is what you're seeing and what you're experiencing.
Then they have to interpret that data.
They do. And so it's important to give them accurate information so they can make good decisions that are safe decisions. They would be better off with no information from the airplane than bad information. Because if they had no information, they could at least read their environment around them and act accordingly. If I give them something that is inaccurate and they make a decision based off that, then they could be at risk.
Now, tell us, you talk about, is the UP fire detection any different than here in the northern lower peninsula?
We have currently two full-time DNR pilots in the lower peninsula, and we have the same in the upper peninsula. Now, we can't cover the whole state with just four pilots, so we do have to contract some of our detection routes. And so we have one contract in the upper, and then we have two in the lower. But essentially, the task is the same. Now, I will say, in the upper peninsula, you have less roads, you have more wilderness areas, whereas we can give a section, township, and a range.
And there's a
quite
road
easily
somewhere.
Here. There's a road somewhere. Up there, they would rely more on coordinates off their GPS. And they can relay that information to their incident command center. And then it gets disseminated from there. But their role over the fire is identical to ours.
Are there any stories or experiences that are memorable in your experience of air detection?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, the cell phone is so prevalent now. So a lot of the reports come in from, you know, people on the ground. But I think it's those instances where that wasn't reported. It could be a remote lightning strike. And I can go back to last year, actually. There was a fire similar to the size of the Wilderness Trail fire. It was called the Blue Lakes Fire. It went about 2,500 acres. I was actually on a wildlife survey. We were doing a waterfowl count and noticed a smoke during the survey. And it was before noon, so it wasn't when we would expect to find a fire per se. But recognize it was a wildfire, it was very remote, and we were able to get that information to our ground resources to get them activated. Had we not been up, you know, if we'd been up a little bit later, it'd give that fire a little more of a head start. And I will tell you this, there are only certain things you can do with a jack pine fire, because when it's crowning, it's probably gonna run its course. We can steer the flanks somewhat, but very critical to save life. And the sooner we can get there, we can determine if there's gonna be evacuations needed. We can look and see what is the trajectory of this fire. Are there structures out there that have people in them? Now we can get law enforcement, we can get structure protection engines in there to help with that evacuation. I would say not any one instance, Tom, but I think it's that collection of experiences through the 24 years that I've done this where we develop a camaraderie with our ground forces, a real trust there. It's a very much a family atmosphere. But I think at the end of an experience, you can say, I felt like we made a difference today. we either helped save life or we helped save property. There's really no better feeling than that.
What are you other uses of the DNR aircraft?
That's a good question. You know, the fire season, I will say, usually after the snow melts, so maybe sometime, hopefully by April, and then that extends to usually about this time. We're in a fairly unprecedented stretch of fire season.
You're probably supposed to be doing something else.
Yes, huh? By now we're usually moving on to forest health surveys or these types of things. So this has been a fairly long fire season until what we call green up is typically when we stop. So if we go like mid-April to maybe early June, but we're a year-round resource. So as I mentioned, we do forest health surveys where we will grid much of the state and we will carry our forest health specialists and they will literally map areas of defoliation from the different pests that can come in, whether it's, you know, spongy moth or if it's eastern tent caterpillar, and there's any number of, you know, budworm, you know, instances they get into the pine. And then the fall time is usually when we work with the law enforcement folks. So we're helping them enforce game laws. So, okay, you know, October into November. And then in the winter time, when we have snow on the ground and leaf off, that's when we do most of our wildlife surveys. And that would include...
How do you survey? I mean, do you just count a one, two, three, or...
Yes, well, that's a good question, and depending on what species we're surveying. But we have a moose survey in the Upper Peninsula, so that area just to the west of Marquette, over towards Lance, you know, that area in there. And then, likewise, an elk survey that we do in the Lower Peninsula, basically from Gaylord over towards Hillman area along the M32 corridors, our core elk area. And in both of those instances, we'll fly at 500 feet above the ground.
Is that pretty low?
That's pretty low. That's quite low. You can see the animals very well. And we fly in the Lower Peninsula like 6 miles, then you step over a quarter mile and fly back. And so you'll have these little quadrants. So it's, you're not missing anything. That's the theory. Of course you miss things. But we have these models that we can put that data into, and then they can come up with a census to determine what is the number of elk that we have. And they can help set hunting quotas, for instance. And the moose, we don't hunt moose, but they do want to know what is the population with the moose. So that's where that data comes in very useful. Today, one of my counterparts just did a black bear survey. So we have five in the Lower Peninsula, five sows, the female bears, that have telemetry collars. And we can locate them from the air. And that's a really fascinating program. It's what we call a surrogate sow program. If you could imagine in the spring of the year, if a sow that had cubs, and they could have anywhere from one to maybe four cubs, if that sow were hit by a car or something, now you have these cubs that are orphaned. What do you do with them? And euthanizing them wouldn't be the best solution. And the public, I don't think, would want to have us do such a thing anyway. The zoos have plenty of bear, so
you better keep them out there in the wild.
Yeah, how can you keep them in the wild? Well, at that size, they probably aren't going to live on their own. So we keep these sows with collars on them so that we can locate them, and then we can place the orphan cubs with those sows.
Foster sows.
Yeah, it's like a foster family. And the way we do that is you actually walk in on the sow, and she has cubs. We make sure we know what sows, they only have cubs every other year. So we know if they have yearlings or if they have new cubs of that year. But when the biologists walk in, that sow will put her cubs up a tree for safety, and then she'll wander out maybe 100 yards or so watching. The biologist will notice what tree her cubs are in, take the orphan, and they'll put Vicks Vapor Rub on that orphan cub and send it up the same tree. And then they'll lather up the tree trunk actually with that Vicks. In the meantime, those cubs are all mingling together, putting their scent, that Vicks scent, on her cubs. And then the biologists get away, and when the sow calls her cubs down, they apparently don't count very well.
Okay.
But they will clean them up. You know, they have that Vicks on there, so that masks the scent of the orphan. And in the meantime, she cleans them up and transfers her scent onto that orphan. And the success rate is just phenomenal.
Wow.
For her to adopt those cubs. So that would be an example of where we'd use an airplane in a non-traditional sense. And then the other thing I will mention is the Bald Eagle program. I've flown a lot of years for the Bald Eagle program. And one of the gentlemen that I used to fly with, he's recently passed away, Jerry Weinrich, he was started flying the bald eagle surveys in the early 70s when he knew there were of only 30 nests in the Lower Peninsula. And I got to fly with him over all these years, and we saw that program expand to where these eagles have recovered to where, you know, there's 700, 800 nests from 30. So it was fascinating to have an individual in the airplane that had that background, that history, and all that biology. Now, we still do the surveys. We just don't do the whole state. They've recovered quite well. But there are areas of concern that we want to make sure the population and the health of those eagles do well. People literally will climb those trees. We have biologists that will climb them, and they'll take samples from those eaglets, you know, blood samples, feather samples, weigh them. They'll put band on them so they can keep track of them. But it's a way of determining the health of the system, ecosystem.
Waterfowl, do you do anything with waterfowl?
We do. This state here, many people don't realize this, but if you were to think about Michigan, it encompasses over 96,000 square miles. 40,000 of those square miles are water.
Yeah.
It's second only to Alaska when it comes to shoreline. And so we have a lot of waterfowl. And this is a great place to determine trends in population. So we'll fly biologists. They can identify, they're very good at this, they can identify the types of ducks it is, and they can estimate size. And some of these rafts will go, you know, 3,000, 4,000, even 5,000 ducks in a raft or more. And they have an eye to determine how to estimate those as we fly by.
Awesome. Kevin, who are we going to be talking to next, and what is his role?
This is Randy Hartman, and he's one of the forest fire officers based at the Roscommon Field Office.
Now, what is the structure of the firefighting process? Where does he fit in through the puzzle?
Well, the firefighters really are boots on the ground for us, the fire officers. They're the ones that operate the equipment on the fires. We have, you know, bulldozers with plows on the back that he would operate. We also have off-road engines, so this would be a unit that would support one of the bulldozers when we're off road.
So let me get this context. You're the guy in the air.
Yes.
So you're basically the Air Force, and what we've heard about military procedures and stuff, that the Air Force can do a lot of prep work, but literally air support, but literally the boots on the ground is what holds the territory.
It is. We do a fine job of locating fires. We even have aerial suppression resources, but the fire is put out from the ground. So that's something that Randy and his co-workers do.
So this is literally the person hand-to-hand combat, for lack of terms. These are the guys that are in danger's way, and this is the literally the front line.
It is, and I'm sure Randy could tell you some of those experiences and some of the heat that they encounter on these fires.
Very good. Randy, give us an idea. We think about forest fires as way out there, you know, somewhere out in the west, western United States, Canada, right now as we're speaking. Earlier this week, there's a fire burning, and so we're literally we saw smoke the other day, we're supposed to see smoke all across the eastern United States. What is it like? You're really at the front, and we think that far away, not here in our home area in Michigan. Tell us what it's like, and what's your operations, boots on the ground?
Well, quite often we'll get a call from Kevin here, one of his pilots in one of the other planes, where they have eyes on smoke and they're going to investigate it, get a location for us. They'll be in contact with us. They'll give us a location, help us find our way in, and at that point we unload, as Kevin said, this tractor right here.
Well, explain it. How big is it?
This is a Cat D2 bulldozer.
Pretty chunky. It's not super long. It's kind of compact but big and strong.
It is. It has 102 horsepower. It has like a single bottom plow attached to the back of it.
What's the purpose of that?
That's our cutting tool.
Okay.
We put that in the ground. We lay it down. We put it in the ground, and we start flanking the fire as a rule. And
that goes along the side.
We start flanking around the side of the fire. Kevin gives us intel on that as to what might be the best side to start on. And then we put that plow on the ground. We expose the mineral soil.
Okay, and why is that important?
because we're removing that vegetation
for
any ground fire.
You're getting to that subsoil.
Absolutely. And then behind the dozer, as Kevin explained, we'll put an engine in behind us.
Okay, and give the length. That's like almost 25, 30 feet long.
That's a big boy there. That's a 5-ton military 6x6. It's a program that we have. And we build a fire engine out of that, the apparatus. We get the cab and frame and we build an apparatus on the back over our forest fire experiment station. And what that engine will do is he'll tuck in behind this bulldozer, he'll give us some room to work, and that engine will hold that line, make sure that fire doesn't escape across that plow line with that mineral soil exposed that I just mentioned.
And now, does he have water in it? It looks like is it like a fire engine or
it
what?
It is. He has approximately 1,500 gallons of water on that truck there.
Okay.
It has a pump on the back so it can, what we refer to as pump and roll. It has a pump all separate for itself for the tank. There's hoses that come out each side, and they just monitor us and they monitor the fire. And what we try to do is we try to flank that fire, and we try to come all the way around. We have the flanks are the sides. We have a left and a right.
Okay.
The point of origin is where the fire started, and we start around the flank of the fire. If it's a cooking fire, if it's really going, we'll deploy more task force on that fire.
Another units, more
exactly.
Units.
Another usually dozer engine type situation.
So you're kind of a pair.
Yes, and we'll flank that fire. One might take one side, the other one will take the other side, depending on fire behavior. And in a perfect world, we'll flank around that fire, we'll cut across the head, and it'll all stay contained within those lines.
So you go down where it hasn't done it yet, or is it the flames that literally at that head?
You know, it's up to the individual. You monitor the fire behavior, you listen to the pilot, what he's seeing ahead of us, the fire behavior that he's seeing, what's going on behind us, and we try to work as close to that fire as we can safely, wherever our comfort level is. Everybody's is a little bit different, and you just kind of have to judge it to think, well, if I'm too close, it's going to spot over.
Jump right over the top of you and start the next area.
Exactly.
Next
if we're
it.
Too far away, it's going to build up a head of steam and blow over it. And then if you have wind, you have all kind of different things that you need to take into consideration. The timber type, whether it's grass or trees or both.
What's the difference?
It starts in the fine fuels. They're okay. Drying out first and earliest. You know,
that's more grasses.
The trees
and
still have a little bit of moisture in them. As we advance through the early spring into late spring, maybe early summer, now our pine trees are just volatile. The jack pine, we have a lot of jack pine around northern Michigan, and the jack pine are just volatile. The trees are candle, and if you get a chance to look at a jack pine tree, you'll see it looks like a candle on the very end of the branches.
Okay.
And what the tree does is it'll suck up the moisture that it can get,
yes.
Which we don't have much of right now. But it'll suck up that moisture through the roots, it'll shoot it up the tree and out to the very end, supporting that new growth.
Right.
And then, so what that does is that dries the rest of the tree out. And
so
as Kevin can tell you or has told you, he'll watch those trees, they'll start, the fire will burn across on the grass, it'll start climbing those branches, and it'll just take right off. And then we call that, if it's just one tree or two trees, we call that single tree torching. It might get into a group, and then we call it group torching. And then the worst case scenario, the wind will carry it. It'll get up in the crowns of the pine trees, and it'll just race across the crowns. It won't even be on the ground, and those are really hard to deal with. That's where we so appreciate our air resources to try to calm that thing down and get it back down on the ground where we can do some work with the boots on the ground.
Wow.
Randy, we talk about direct attack and indirect attack.
Exactly.
Maybe you could explain a little bit about that. And then we've heard that term, fight fire with fire.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe when you explain the indirect attack,
absolutely,
how we would use such a thing.
So, you know, we try to work direct attack as close as we can. A direct attack is a track in the black, kind of, right close to the fire.
Okay, how many feet, you said it varies, it varies.
It can vary, but like I say, some folks are quite aggressive and that they work as direct to the fire as they can, as close to the fire as we
do
can.
They ever go on top of the fire?
We try not to do that, because
okay.
you don't want to pull the fire out.
Okay. Your plow may actually roll it over to
exactly.
The other side, to
exactly.
The wrong side.
Exactly, so there's a fine line there, but that's the direct attack. We work as close to the fire line as we can, putting in our control line. So And then
that's with a plow that you come with your tractor initially
and put in a control line.
Okay, you can't have the roots and you take all that foliage away, because it could be, if it's a been there for a while, it could be 4-6 inches deep of pines and
absolutely
very volatile.
Absolutely. And as we dry out, that stuff will start burning underground. The fire will move to ground fire and as it burns.
So you've got multiple layers. You've got it possibly going through the root systems underground. You've got it on the ground. You've got it going up the tree. And then the worst case is the crown fires. This is multidimensional.
It's quite a day. It's quite a day when that happens.
You have adrenaline running, or you're pretty calm?
You know, I don't know. you just kind of do what you do. We're a little crazy sometimes, you know, like we do what we do because that's what we do. And Kevin keeps good eyes on us. Him and his partners, there is no doubt in my mind that there are days where they're thinking we are their number one concern.
Yeah.
I know that for a fact. So then we'll talk about indirect attack.
Okay.
So depending on where the fire, how the fire is burning, really hot, what kind of fuel it might be coming into or already currently in, we might have to back off a little bit and give it some room. It might be because it might be burning in some low ground, and if we keep going, we're going to get stuck.
Okay.
That's the last thing we want. Yeah,
because that takes you out of
absolutely
service.
So we go to an indirect attack, and so we might back off that line. You know, it varies. However far we need to back off, we'll back off. Now the problem we have there is now we have unburnt fuel between the fire and our control line.
Right.
So we need to take care of that. And as Kevin mentioned, sometime we'll do what we call black lining.
Okay.
And so we'll take a person off of the engine usually, or if we have a second person that's kind of scouting on the ground, or however it might work out. And they'll take a drip torch. I have one on the back of my tractor there.
Okay, what does it look like?
Can I jump up there?
Yeah, you may. Please. It's easy. He's got a flatbed trailer here behind a semi on a gooseneck. And this tractor, this big tractor that's about 8 or 10 feet tall, and it's about 14 feet long. He's put, it looks like a thermos jug here. This is what you're talking about.
Yes, sir. And so inside of here is a torch. So what we'll do is we'll take this top off, flip it upside down, and it'll be about this tall then.
Okay.
And there's a fuel mixture in here that we'll light.
It kind of looks like a fire extinguisher too, but it's doing just the opposite.
Exactly. And so that wick will stay lit on the torch.
Okay.
And when we tip it down onto the ground, a little bit of that fuel will come across the burning wick.
Okay.
And drop on the ground and set the ground on fire.
Okay.
And so when we're in that indirect attack and we're a ways off of the fire line and our control line, we need to burn that fuel up.
You're just expanding the area that is already, it can't burn. You're trying to pre-burn it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And, you know, we could wait. We could maybe stop and wait for that to work its way out to our control line. But sometimes we don't have that kind of time. So we'll have that person, you know, step back here on our line. And start lighting.
You're just right beside, you're flanking it, right?
Yes.
Beside it. So it actually, it makes it wider. It's not only is where you're able to run the tractor without getting stuck, but that area you've made that a safe zone also.
Absolutely.
And so you're butting up against it. So actually that area is wider. And so when it comes up, it has actually a bigger buffer.
Ideally, we burn from our control line back to the fire. So it all comes together and goes out.
And it burns way out there.
And again, that's that good day, that perfect day when that happens. So that's a little bit about direct attack and indirect attack. Everybody does it a little bit different. We use our pilots a ton.
So how often would you talk to your pilot in a typical situation? How many minutes apart?
Well, it just there's conversation going on all the time.
The wind is going, it probably changes the whole formula.
It can. And keep in mind, he's not only talking to myself and my engine. He's watching the whole fire, and he might have another task force on the other side that he's watching out for, and he's letting those folks know what's going on also. And now the fire is growing and it's getting a little more hectic and more resources come in, and he's helping them get in, and they might get stuck coming in or what have you.
Because you got soft soils, you got marshy
roads.
Could you have marshy, even though it's a dry area, you might have to go through
Absolutely.
A swampy area or something.
And now air attack's coming in. So now he has air resources coming in, dumping water on the fire force. So he's a busy man.
So he's making the calls.
He's watching it all. He's up high. He gets out of the way and he lets everybody do their work. But he isn't far. He's up high, but he's not far away.
Yeah, I don't know if you're the person to talk to, Randy, or not, but who is the person on what a size of a fire? When do you have one crew out there? When do you have a task force? When do you have a multiple task force? Help us get a picture on that.
That's a good question. So, you know, it kind of starts with the initial size up where the fire's at. What's the timber type? And Kevin knows that. Kevin sees it. Kevin will see the fire. He's told us before, I've located a fire east of West Branch or north of West Branch. That's a good area. I've located a fire north of West Branch. He said it's definitely, and he'll look at it. He might come back very few seconds later. This is building. It's definitely a wildfire. So we know that's a jack pine area. So we have some areas that we already have designated as zone areas. Those are where there are highly volatile fuels, and we have a set dispatch for what equipment rolls.
You have a category, and so absolutely, you don't have to think about it. This fire, so this amount of resources are deployed.
And so somebody will say, who's listening, this is a zone 1 fire, this is a zone 3 fire, you know, and then our dispatch center up front will usually say, this is a zone 1 fire, and everybody knows what equipment immediately rolls to the fire and what equipment rolls to it, shifts to a different location to be neat where they might be needed in the in that event. It just goes from there. The person that might be, like, if it were me, you know, if I'm in route and I see that column of smoke and we know it's a day like today, feel that breeze.
And what is today? Today is a sunny, clear day, dry. I haven't had rain for weeks with just a little bit.
Absolutely. It could be a day today, sir.
Oh.
And I might be talking to Kevin and Rao and say, hey, you know, Air 5, you know, what are your thoughts here? You know, this is, should we call this a zone fire if it hasn't been called already? And he say yes, or I say, and then, you know, it can be kind of calm talk in route. You know, what do you think about air attack and the fire bosses, or maybe MSP helicopter spinning them up?
Which is Michigan State Police, which is another story we're going to talk about later.
Yes, sir. So, you know, there's that conversation kind of going on, and then we go from there, we start ordering resources as needed. You can always turn them around. Yep. You know, and so better safe than sorry at this point, and that's how we roll.
Well, Randy, this has been a treasure of a interview, but I got to ask two questions. How long have you been doing this? And the next question to follow that is, tell me one of your best stories.
Oh, man. Well, I've been doing it for 29 years now. I'm glad you didn't ask me when I was going to retire.
Okay.
Because my wife is wondering. Okay. Stories, you know. I don't really have. I mean, we've had some good fires, and you know, I call them good fires because I love it. They're in a better job in the world, and there have been a lot of homes lost and property lost due to it. So it's not a good fire, but it's just it's good when we can all come together.
The teamwork.
Oh, absolutely. We put it together. When you jump out and grab a, you know, it doesn't matter to me if I'm on this dozer, if I'm on an engine, and you roll into a residence and you can grab that hose off the back and tell your partner to fire up the pump, and you just that hose reel just zings and you're pulling it off, and you know, we don't go inside the structure. We can't do that because we don't have the personal protection equipment for interior. But we can sure stop it just before it gets there, or put the siding out as it's drooping and melting. So I guess I can't really think of a favorite fire it's just good. And I know this sounds corny, but I work for the people and they appreciate it, and they let me know that whether I see them in a grocery store or the post office or at a special meeting someplace or something. So absolutely, thank you for allowing me this time to tell our story.
Absolutely. One other question. And were you involved, many of our listeners, Grayling and Camp Asabo is near and dear to their heart. Were you a part of that fire?
I was. We were on standby.
Okay.
And so we rolled to that fire right from standby. That fire had its, how do you call it, hurdles. You know, we had to pull a couple of the engines into the fire to go to work because of the road system and so on. And it was a working fire, I'd say. Kevin, would you agree?
I would, and I think you saw the components there that Randy spoke of earlier. You had the torching, group torching, you had the full chrome. And one of the things that we watch really closely from the air is spotting.
Okay.
And in that case, that fire was...
What is spotting?
So spotting is, you know, you have those pine trees...
Oh, that's right.
...burning, plus a little wind pushing. So it'll put firebrands a quarter mile out in front of that fire. So
it's feeding another one.
It's feeding another one. They draw into each other. Those little spot fires grow into, you know, pretty serious fire activity in of themselves. And probably the single most important thing that I watch as a pilot for someone like Randy is when we get lateral spot fires off the side of their line. So he's putting in control line with this tractor plow unit. But if we call it slop over sometimes, where the fire gets across his line, or if it spots across his line, if you could imagine now, Randy can't see through that brush behind him, but there's a fire literally growing behind him coming up, you know, from his rear. So without us there to tell them, hey, you need to double back, you've got slop over, and you can get, you know, take care of that, or they might bump an engine up there to put some water. What happens from the air is everything looks dry and everything looks level.
Okay.
But the reality is, Randy would tell you as he's driving in, that's not level. That's got a lot of sand on a hill. So
I can't quite get there that way. I may have to go around that or something.
And on that fire you just referenced, the Wilderness Trail fire, it was a challenge to get equipment to there. We could get a bulldozer to it quite easily, but to take an engine in with the sand and the, you know, the tight trails, it was pretty tough.
As our listeners, you're used to living in urban areas and on paved streets, and then maybe you go camping or whatever and you find out what your vehicle can't do. Sometimes you run into that. Anything else, Randy, you wanted to share?
Okay. Kevin touched on it. I missed the spot fire thing. And it, you know, the fire that might have just slopped over our line, that might be easily detected quickly. Maybe our engine behind us will see it. That's what they're there for, to hold that line. But the spot fire out that we don't see, the last place we want to be is in between having fire on both sides of us. And that's what Kevin watches. He's our lookout up there. And all the other pilots, we have four. Or five?
Yeah, traditionally five. We have four right now.
That work between the Upper Peninsula and down here, and we've gotten they're like family. We've gotten to know them, count on them, trust in them, and they trust our judgment, and we trust their stage.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Randy. It's truly appreciate it. This has exceeded expectations.
I'm glad that I was able to be a part of this, and I hope that I was able to shed a little bit of light on it for the listeners.
Absolutely. Kevin, we are in an office now. Before we were out in the field. Where are we, and what is the function of this building?
Well, when we were outside visiting with Randy, you saw the equipment firsthand, but those don't come off the shelf looking like that.
You can't buy that at your local Chevrolet dealer.
If you go to the CAT dealer, it's not going to look like that. And then likewise with the different engines that we use off-road. Again, you might recognize the emblem on the front of it, but once you get behind the cab, it's all different. So what we are setting in now is what we call the Forest Fire Experiment Station. Pretty unique opportunity here for an agency to build up their own equipment. So with us today is Kevin Jaskowski, and he's one of the engineers for the Forest Fire Experiment Station.
Kevin, I'm really excited about this. I and our listeners have a lot to learn. We didn't even know you existed, so you've got a lot of training here to do. What do you do? What happens in this building, and what makes it so unique?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. You know, actually, before I started here, I didn't realize the Michigan's DNR even had a firefighting division. I knew forestry and that, you know, kind of planting
you think of the
trees,
campsites,
yep,
and
cutting
whatever.
Trees, making it look nice for campers. But yes. So what we do is the state has a good size wildland fire program. It's part of our Forest Resource Division, which is also the guys who plant trees and handle that kind of things as well. But in order to fight wildland fire in Michigan, we need some specialized equipment. And as Kevin Jacob said, you can't just go to a dealer you know, and find that. There are a few unique manufacturers that do make structure trucks, and they kind of can dabble with some what they call brush equipment, but it's not on an everyday basis. You know, it's more of a just kind of a side thing for them. So many years ago, all the way back to the 1930s, this our facility here, not the one we're standing in now, but you can see some remnants of the old buildings here.
It's old cement block. Yeah. It looks old.
Yeah, so built on site by CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps. Yeah, way
this
back.
This is real stuff.
Yeah. So at that time, you know, conservation officers and equipment for them and all that, I think, was manufactured here. But one of the biggest or the most probably biggest advantage that Michigan had is they developed what was the fireline plow, and basically that was a
that developed here.
Yeah. Wow. And you
that's
know,
quite an accomplishment.
Yep. Originally, they would pull those behind, you know, an old clay tractor, you know, some sort of tracked device, and you know, it was able to basically make fire break or a plow line around in order to keep fire hopefully in and out of areas, you know, for firefighting, as well as they would have some sort of water units, maybe an old engine, and you can go back to see things in the 50s and 60s where they would put water tanks on them and be spraying, you know, fire wildland fires in Michigan.
So they basically said we could do better than this.
Yeah, so a lot of history here, and a lot of, you know, sort of design and build work that we had. You can kind of see some of our old blueprint drawings that were.
There's a file, a horizontal file with.
Yep, very large and historic drawings that would have been from, you know, many of these. Even some of these on the top of the pile will go back, you know, over 30 years. We've got stuff all the way back. There's records all the way back to the 30s and stuff on a lot of this. So, you know, there's been a lot of knowledge that's sort of been passed down through the years. You know, that's kind of the thing Michigan's been able to do is sort of keep up with technology and improvements. With our facility here, we use computer aided drafting, 3D modeling, to basically build up the trucks in a, you know, sort of concept or prototyped development. We can then generate drawings that will go to our shop floor, as well as, you know, needing their expertise as far as getting these all these water apparatus and pumps and all that to fit and do what they're supposed to on the trucks and perform in a way that, you know, I think would exceed what you would get from another manufacturer. I mean, it's, you know, many of our staff here help out on fire, so they get to actually use the equipment. You know, so you sort of get a design and build and a verification cycle all in one, because, you know, we're kind of all part of it.
The next fire is where you experiment.
Yeah. So one of the unique things that in Michigan we're able to do is we have an agreement with National Forest, U.S. Forest Service, and also with military DOD. So we're able to get from those agencies sometimes used equipment. So we've in the past used military, what
retrofit
we call it. 6x6, yeah, a 6x6 truck that's all-wheel drive.
It's a four-way drive. It's a six-wheel drive.
Yep. So, and they can haul a lot of water. They're very large, heavy duty. But through the years, you know, those have changed. Of course, the equipment you saw in, say, a Vietnam era is no longer being produced. So now there's new ones. But we can accommodate those, you know, by reviewing the design and the makeup of how those are put together. We can figure out what's the best apparatus to go on those. Same thing with current, what we call tractor plow. So basically your construction bulldozer that we may get that we modify to again put on the Michigan fire plow on the back and then add things to the front and stuff inside the cab, you know, for operator safety, for better firefighting, faster, quicker.
You know, we refer to that as the Michigan fire plow. Do other states or agencies utilize that apparatus that has been designed here?
Yeah, good question. What we have is not only at this facility are we working under the Michigan DNR, but we have a sort of multi-state or you know, sort of large organization that called the Roscommon Equipment Center. And what that does is basically the other states basically share knowledge. They provide a little bit, you know, funding from each state too. And we try, any of our plans that we develop for our equipment is available to those agencies outside of the state. We try to host a workshop in the fall where multi-states come here and they can actually drive our equipment, try out our equipment. Sometimes we've had other states like Wisconsin bring their equipment here. So it's a great knowledge sharing. It's a great way to sort of help out other states as well as, you know, sort of benchmark or see who's doing what. Does that work better? What are the advantages, disadvantages?
What is the greatest accomplishment that you feel has happened during your tenure?
Well, you know, just sort of providing the support that's needed for firefighting is, you know, it can be as simple as some of the equipment that we had here recently and even this week from, you know, of course, this large fire we had over in Grayling. And, you know, as far as the water equipment and those things, you know, pumps and that stuff might mechanically go out, needs to be replaced. So in order to be able to do that quickly and efficiently, we're not the only facility that can do that. We have other repair shops, Gaylord, Marquette, and all that. Communication is great. We do what we got to do to get people parts or those things. But, you know, sort of being able to provide a product that works well for the firefighters and that we can support, that's the ultimate goal here. You know, we've gone through some changes in designs, old steel tanks that, you know, we had problems with rusting and those things throughout the years. Now we're following, you know, technology to plastic and poly tanks, and just recently we released a very large Navistar truck with a poly tank. It was one of the biggest water tanks, poly ones, that we've done, and that's up in the UP and been used up there. So
that's important because you might be a long place from a water source.
Correct. Yep. And ultimately durability. I mean, the state, you know, is paying for this stuff. You know, hopefully we can get 20 years out of it. You know, your average car and that kind of stuff, they sort of benchmark 10 years. Well, we would like to do better than that. So,
right.
So that's kind of, you know, getting the state, I guess, biggest bang for their buck and providing our firefighters the best equipment they can have while they're, you know, fighting these fires and protecting our resources.
Kevin, thanks so much. This has been a pleasure, and thank you for your service.
Yeah.
And we're so glad that you're behind the scenes fighting fires for the men on the front line and for us here in the community.
Yeah. Well, I've been happy to help and assist. You know, definitely our fire officers and assisting personnel and everybody that, you know, as you say, the team that comes together on, you know, when things happen, it's nice to see how they can really respond and be able to protect people, number one, you know, the property, number two, and finally, our natural resources.
So. Amen. Thank you. Well, Kevin, we'll need to move on.
We do.
Okay. Thanks again.
Yep.
Kevin, this has been a great interview. I really appreciate all the people that we visited. Can you kind of summarize what we've seen today?
Of course. You know, we're just so happy that you're able to come and visit us in our hangar to see our aircraft and the program that we have here. But I think what you've found is that there's people here with passion. We visited with Randy, and that really showed through when he talked about his love for his job. And then, of course, at the experiment station with Kevin Jaskowski. And it would have been nice to have input from everybody that we saw today. Obviously, with the time that we have, I think we had a real good experience with Kevin and Randy. But I will say, people care about their jobs here. The passion shows through, and we just really so much enjoy our task.
People who are making a difference.
They make a difference.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for being our co-host today on Strong Tower Radio today, and we'll be praying for you while you're up in the air.
Thank you. We take that.
Folks, you've been listening to Strong Tower Radio today. I'm your host, Tom Azure. We're in Northern Michigan in Roscommon. Until next time, bye now.